The following is a presentation of Open for Business, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's conference for business students and business professionals at the Urbana 06 Missions Convention, held in St. Louis, December 2006. For more information, please visit ofb.intervarsity.org.
When I first started working for Opportunity, I found it as my sweet spot where my passion met the needs of the world. And I think that's really what we look at in calling, is meeting those two places. Attractive. Most of us are familiar with this quotation from Micah, to do justice. But sometimes we don't read further. And to hear the part about loving mercy and walking humbly with our God. And as I've come into more international work, I also see that it's walking humbly with the people that we serve in other countries, knowing that there is much that we can learn from them, and that it's only together as the body of Christ that we can address these issues of social injustice. I'm going to go back and forth between the work of Opportunity and what we do in addressing justice to some of the bigger pictures of justice. Drew is going to come in. He's one of my successful business colleagues, and talk about his calling. And then at the end, I will address some of the inequities toward women, and again, some more examples of how Opportunity addresses justice. If we have enough time, I have a five-minute video I'd like you to see, too. But I'm concerned that as we go forward, and as all of you are looking at what is the next step, God, and remember what Jeff Van Duser said about every good organization, every great organization should have a mission statement, and that serves as a screen that you make sure that all of your work will fit within. Well, I want you to see Opportunity's mission statement. And focus on, our focus is on people in poverty, and that they would be able to transform their lives. And we are motivated by Christ's call to serve the poor. And calling, in our definition, and this is actually from our mission statement, is a combination of being in a place where what we do matches who we are and what needs to be done. So again, it's that our skills meet the needs of the poor. But in saying who we are, it also implies that to know who we are coming closer to God. So as my mentor, Jim Houston, would say, that double knowledge. The closer you are to God, the more you know yourself. And that's something for us to struggle with as we look at organizations that we want to join, or if we're forming our own businesses and writing our mission statements, to look at both our mission and how that fits with our calling. So let's start with Opportunity and what motivated the start of Opportunity. Who knows where this is?
Bombay.
Exactly, Bombay. This picture was taken in Bombay 10 years ago, now Bombay. And it shows the stark contrast between poverty and wealth, and probably that contrast is even starker now. And this perception of the inequitable distribution of wealth is what moved two businessmen in two different parts of the world to start the work that eventually became Opportunity. First, it was David Busseau, who was an Australian contractor who was working in Bali. He saw the extreme poverty, and he decided, I have skills. I have business skills that I can bring to bear, and I can, through God's hand, help these people to develop the skills that they can help themselves and move their way out of poverty. So he started that work out of his own funds. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to David, another man in Colombia, Al Whitaker, a U.S. executive of a large corporation, saw the same disparities, the inequalities of wealth in Colombia, and did the same thing. He started giving small loans to small businesses so that they could generate employment. Now, isn't this just like our God, to be moving in different people at different places for his purposes? then 2 years later, they met, were astounded that they were doing the same thing, knew that it was God's work, and formed the organization, which later was named Opportunity. So we go back about 36 years. But now let's go back to the big picture. Okay, they saw injustice in individual locations. If we look at the whole world, what injustice do we see? It's pretty severe. This study just came out the first part of December, and it looks at wealth, which is assets minus debts, which is more accurate than just looking at income. So we see that 10% of the richest adults own 85% of the total global wealth. In fact, 1% of the richest adults own 40% of the total global wealth. And then the statistics make up that 1%. I feel guilty about that. I don't know about you, but yeah, it's inequitable. But if we look at the other side of the coin, what do we see there? We see that 50% of the world's adult population own only 1% of the world's wealth. In fact, as we've heard many times in this conference, 1.2 billion people live in extreme poverty, less than $1 a day. And those are the people that Opportunity targets as our market. The extremely poor who are economically viable. But look, half of the population of the globe live on less than $2 US per day. And where are these people? Well, it's not really a surprise to us that the red countries are 60 to 80% of the people in that country live on less than a dollar a day. Opportunity is in Uganda and Malawi, in Africa. We're also in Uganda, and in Ghana, which is in orange. And you see Niger and Nigeria, and quite a few other countries have that extreme poverty. So these are the areas of the world where the need is. One of my, radical thinkers in the field of public health, because that is my field, is Paul Farmer. How many know Paul Farmer? Yeah. He's a doctor and an anthropologist, and he's coined a term called structural violence. And I like that term because he talks about systems. It can be corporate systems, it can be governmental policies, it can be cultural traditions, it could even be church traditions in our context. They're historical conditions, often economically driven, that promote disequity or a negative impact on society. So what impacts do poverty have on society? I think I'm going to need you to do this. I'm pushing them too fast. Well, first we know that 1.2 billion have no access to safe drinking water, and 2.6 billion lack basic sanitation. And we've started to hear how businesses can address some of those justice issues. In one of our business competitions, there was UV technology for water purification and bringing that into a society. And Ram told us about a straw that was filtered so that it could purify water. So there are different solutions that we can bring practically to bear. But I think as we look at these different impacts, well, what does that look like? These are some of the substandard housing conditions in Uganda. And then we have a playground for children in Honduras, close to the stream. The educational impacts are also high. 103 million eligible children are not in primary school. And many of those children are in sub-Saharan Africa, less than 60% of children complete primary school. 25% of girls in developing countries go beyond the fifth grade, so 75% don't reach that area. And education has kind of a continuing effect, because if the mom is uneducated, child mortality rates are higher in that family. And then we get to some of the health impacts. And as a public health professional, these really affect me. 6 million children die from malnutrition before their fifth birthday. Another 11 million die from preventable infectious diseases. And then we talk about AIDS, there's 40 million, and I know last night the woman from Zambia told us that AIDS is much more than the statistics, and I'm going to give some individual examples later. But one of the things that breaks my heart is the 15.2 million AIDS orphans. And in fact, we have seen some villages that are run by children in some of the countries where we serve. We talked about structural violence and some of the cultural traditions. Maybe most of you are familiar with the tradition in Malawi that says if the husband dies of AIDS, brother comes in, takes over the assets, and then has responsibility for the family. But in the chaos of the current economic situation, the first part is true. The family members come in, they take over the assets. In this case, it was a Toyota truck and a bank account. This is the front page of the New York Times. But they don't necessarily take care of the family. And this happened to one of our partners in Malawi. And fortunately for the woman, she had opened a bank account at the Malawi Bank. And in that bank, Malawi is the second poorest country in Africa. There are no unique identifiers, no social security cards, no driver's license. So our bank had to come up with a way of having a unique identifier. And what we did through DFID funding from England, we developed a microchip that could have the imprint of the fingerprint. Thank you, Drew. And it looks just like this. See this little gold microchip where the fingerprint is? We're in the second poorest country in Africa, and they have fingerprint identification in our bank. And what was the impact on that family? Well, the brother took the card from the house. He took it into the bank. They, you know, put the laser beam over it and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, sir, but it's not your fingerprint. The money cannot be taken." And so the woman comes back and she is thrilled because this stabilizes her family's income. In a time of crisis, they at least have some economic stability. And then she goes and tells her friends, and not just a few friends. They have a tradition in Malawi that instead of bridal showers, they have kitchen showers, and the older women tell wisdom to the younger women, because that's something they have to give. So her wisdom was, open a bank at the Opportunity Malawi, open a banking account at the Opportunity Malawi Bank. And so she did. And so that bank really got off the ground with savings accounts. And within, I think, the first year and a half, we had 20,000 savings accounts in Malawi. And those families have secured savings. Not just loans, but it's also savings. We talked about some of the structural violence in government policies. We've had several issues in countries that we serve in sub-Saharan Africa where the governments have come in and have bulldozed the micro-enterprises from the city centers. They term this cleaning the rubbish, but then what they do is displace women like Evelyn into the rural areas. And at 6 months, we had not found where she had relocated to. But so we need to also address some of those issues in the government. So now I've painted kind of the broad picture of some of the justice issues. And these are identified in both the millennial goals. Eradicating poverty is the first of their goals. Poverty is a direct correlation with poor health. So you see some of the health issues farther down the way. One of the things that I found interesting, and I do thank you all for coming after my warm-up speaker over at the door, Rick Warren, that you came over here afterwards. But just in case for those of you that missed him, the next slide, his global Goliath, there's a lot of overlap between what Warren has said and what the millennial goals are. So this kind of points us in the direction that we need to look at the justice issues that we are facing and that we want to address. So we're back to calling. Because there are some latecomers. I just want to address that calling is our looking at our giftedness in relationship to the needs of the world. And where do those match? And that's one of the tests of knowing where we are going in the right direction with our work. I think Ron said it really well when he talked about his heart being broken when he saw the poverty in India. So when you look at these justice issues, what breaks your heart? What moves you to action? For opportunity, it was the poverty issue. And so our action was focusing on credit. We started with funding entrepreneurs so that they could create more jobs. And then we moved to microcredit loans in small groups of 30 to 40, predominantly women, and the average loan size being $159 within the trust banks. And we do have a 98% repayment rate, which is quite admirable. Opportunity All looks at fiscal responsibility. Overall, our network, we're both operationally and financially sustainable. But then we listened to our clients and started hearing, besides savings, what other financial products would they need. And they identified that insurance. And we'll talk more about what kinds of insurance we're now offering. And the 300,000 number includes family members that are also not covered by the insurance. So when opportunity, how we measure success, we have the triple bottom line that BAM emphasizes, economic, social, spiritual, but that's under the heading of transformation. So we're really looking for transformation, holistic transformation in our clients, in our staff, in our donor base, sustainability, and then outreach. We look to countries where we can go in and have a larger outreach. I now wanted to pitch it with my partner here, and I'd like to introduce Drew Smith, who is also a volunteer with Opportunity International. He is a successful businessman who has owned his own business, grown his own business, sold the business, and then would it be a second calling for you?
I think so.
Yeah, to come back and to work with microfinance. And so, Drew, if you would.
Thank you, Julie. And I don't want to walk on your time, so you give me a 2-minute warning if I'm talking too much. Welcome. I really welcome all of you who have a heart for missions here in Urbana, and I want to congratulate you for being a part of this organization, and I guess I'm clapping by myself. Let me ask the big question. I'm going to shift gears here a little bit. How many of you are pondering the big question, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? Just checking my audience. Okay, and how many inside that question are asking, where does missions fit? Anybody in that group? Okay, good. Well, I wrote the right speech then. Just check. I'm really excited to be here and share with you my journey. It may be different than your journey, but I learned some things from God through my life that I think can be applied perhaps to others here, so I hope I can be of help to you. And I think one of the key things that I've learned is that every step of the way you learn things in your life that you may not think at the time, but in reality at some point can be useful in God's work. And so I want to try to talk about that a little bit to help you think about how that might be the case in your life. You've read my background a little bit. When I graduated from engineering school in 1980, went to work for Procter & Gamble in manufacturing. You know, I had, hey, we've got PG folks over there. Sorry. Finger doesn't like it. I thought that was my career. In reality, it was just one step of the way to getting to where I ended up being in a calling. And I want to share with you how that calling might grow for you over time. Because I know it's a really tough thing, graduating from college, trying to figure out what your life plan looks like. 7 years after I started working for Procter & Gamble, I and three other partners bought a small manufacturing company in St. Louis, here in town, that makes police equipment, lights and sirens. And the expression kid in the candy store would be a good descriptor for this engineer. Because I loved making all that stuff that you hate to see in the rear view. And we came up with all kinds of funny new noises and lights and colors and all kinds of things. And I just had a blast. And I figured I was going to retire doing this. I had so much fun with it. Well, we grew to about $80 million in sales. And at that point, we really wanted to continue to grow. So we had to find ways to fund that growth. And we're entertaining the idea of selling some of our stock to the public to raise capital to grow, which is called an initial public offering, or IPO. We were right in the middle of that process, and my partner came in to me and said, Drew, we're right in the middle of this IPO thing, but we just got an offer from this organization to buy our company whole. And I laughed and said, you know what? I can do this till I retire. But, by the way, what was the offer?
He handed it to me and I said, whoa, it's sold, here's the keys, I'm gone. I could not believe our company could bring that kind of money. What I didn't realize was that was God moving me on to the next step. And the next step for me was, I thought at least at the time was, hey, this was a great ride, let's do it again. So I formed a venture capital group. We were buying manufacturing companies to do the same thing again, to leverage what we'd done the first time. And that was about the time I got the fax. The fax was from Youth with a Mission. How many people know YWAM? Well, they have a base in San Diego. Anybody familiar with that? Yep. Part of the charge of that base is what they call their Homes of Hope program, where they built homes for the poor in Mexico. And they sent a fax inviting me and my family to come down, spend a long weekend, and build a home for the poor in Mexico. And so I said, this is great. So I loaded up my 8-year-old, my 10-year-old, my wife, and I went down there. And we had a phenomenal experience. How many of you remember the first time you saw the face of power in the developing world? Remember that feeling? Remember how it overcame you? At least it certainly did for me. That was so impactful to spend a day and a half building what we would probably call a storage shed, what they called a palace. We took these people out of tarps and cardboard and handed the keys to the mother of this family. And she said to us, thank you. Because of you, my children will never have to sleep outside. And I was floored. In fact, the last night I was there, I had a dream. And I really had the impression that Jesus was speaking to me and saying, I can touch their hearts, but I can't swing a hammer. Drew, I need you. And I was struck. I really felt like God was giving me a calling to champion the poor of the world. And that was the beginning of my journey. All that preparation up to that point was to match up with that journey that I was going to begin. I then had the opportunity to go on another kind of mission trip, and this one really taught me the difference between relief and development. How many understand the difference? That's pretty basic. I mean, I guess most people, just to kind of check the audience here a little bit, relief being solving a one-time problem versus development, where you try to help the person or group of people solve their own problem in a permanent way. Well, after Hurricane Mitch in 87, anybody remember that? Or the devastation that caused in Honduras? It was phenomenal. That country was destroyed. Hundreds of mission organizations headed to Honduras to help that country rebuild. This organization went down with a slightly different focus. Most went on a relief basis. They wanted to build as many structures as they could and hand them out and leave within 6 months. Impact, the group I went with, was committed there for about 3 years. And they went to this group of people and said they were displaced from all their land, all their property, all their possessions, barely had clothes in their back, and said, we'll help you build a village. We won't do it for you, but we'll show you how. And through that entire process, they spent 3 years showing them how to make concrete blocks, how to build walls, how to build doors and windows, how to put on roofs, how to wire the houses, how to put on a water system, how to put on a septic system, how to build a church, how to raise a pastor, how to solve the problems, how to vote. The list just went on and on and on. And they didn't do any of it for them, but they taught them how. If a hurricane hit Honduras again today, they could rebuild their own village. And it really impacted me to understand the difference between relief and development. And interestingly, as the construction was winding down, it became apparent that the sustenance farming that most of these folks were living on was not going to be adequate enough as far as a stream of income for the long term. I had heard the word microenterprise before, so I was elected to bring microenterprise to this village. Everybody ever been in that position where you spoke up when you shouldn't have? Well, I did. And so I started a world search of all the microenterprise organizations and the ones that worked in Honduras and went through an exhaustive list and figured out there was a bunch there, but none of them served this remote rural area where we were working. So we decided, we've got to do it ourselves. So I went back to Honduras. And I found an organization in the nearby village that was willing to offer loans, but didn't provide any training. And how many of you are familiar with how microenterprise works? One of the key principles is it's not about the loans. It's about the training these people receive so they know how to utilize those loans. So we knew that we couldn't just hand out loans. And I left that office excited that we found somebody who was able to provide the loans, same time depressed that we couldn't find a way to train these people. So the friend I was with, I turned to him and said,
look, we got one day left on this trip. We have no idea where to find somebody who could provide the training. We don't speak the language. We don't know the people. We have to stop right there and just pray to God. And so on that street corner, in this little town in rural Honduras, we stood there and prayed. And we said, thank you, Lord, for letting us be a part of this work. Father, thank you for raising up this organization that's willing to provide the loans. But you know our challenge, Lord. We can't provide the training. We have to find someone who can do the training. We lift it up to you in Jesus' name. And then we said amen and started walking down the street. And I was kind of depressed, feeling like a failure, shuffling my feet. And here I am walking down the street. About a block later, I run into the sandwich board sign and almost trip over it. And I step back, and it's all in Spanish. I can't read a word on it, but then I find a word I can read. And I say, guys, come back here. Look at this. It says Micro Enterprise. And I look up, and it's an organization I never heard of before. And we go in the office. Yeah, you got to see this picture. These two excited gringos going to this office, interrupting these people and talking all about this exciting thing. We're in this village. We need this help. They got to find somebody to do the training. And they look at us like we got three heads. You want us to do what? Go out in the jungle and teach these people what? So we explain some more. And finally, a woman in the office who was a Christian stood up and said, I'll do it. She clearly saw the Spirit of God at work. And she knew she was called to do it. And she did it. And it was wonderful. For the next year, she was able to provide the training. The other organization was able to provide the loans. And I learned a critical thing on that dusty street corner in Honduras. That the strongest men fight their toughest battles on their knees. The strongest men fight their toughest battles on their knees. The time when you are the weakest, God will do the greatest thing. Can I get an amen?
Amen?
Thank you. And I also learned that Micro Enterprise isn't a do-it-yourself kind of thing. It worked for about a year, and then that he couldn't keep doing it, and it kind of fell apart. But it was a tremendous lesson because I learned the fundamentals of how it works. And I got connected then with a lot of Micro Enterprise organizations. And I came across Opportunity International. And you heard a lot of the specifics about what Opportunity International is all about. But the key thing for me is they were the largest Christian-based micro-enterprise organization, and they were not afraid to say, we're here to respond to Jesus Christ called to serve the poor. And they'll say that to anybody. And a lot of the organizations are just socially-based organizations. And if they were Christian, they were a little afraid to explain that they were. In traveling throughout multiple continents around the world, visiting micro-enterprise work, I love to visit the trust banks, which is the heart and soul of the micro-enterprise experiences, where the clients of the micro-enterprise institution are brought together, and Opportunity uses what's called the Grameen model, or the group lending method, where 10 or 20 clients are put together in a group. They all co-sign for each other's loan. So if we're in a group, and I don't make my payment, you and you and you and you and you get to make it for me. So there's a huge internal mechanism of accountability that makes it so successful. One of the reasons why there's a 98% repayment rate associated with it. And when I visit those groups, I always make it a point of asking, mostly women, as Julie pointed out, about 85% of the clients are women, what does it mean to you to be a part of this organization? And without fault, every time I ask that question, I hear two things. One, my children can now adequately eat. And two, my children can be educated. Think about that. Their children consistently can be educated. That means the cycle of poverty is broken in one generation, all because of a $50 loan. That's what effective development is all about. And to me, particularly with my business background, I really appreciated the fact of how the free market at its purest can be extremely effective in solving some of the toughest problems in the world. I think the most memorable experience I had with a trust bank group was in Tegucigalpa, Honduras. I asked that same question, heard those same two things. The last two ladies to speak got up, and the first lady was very jubilant and said, I now know what the Lord meant when he said to Jeremiah, I have great things in store for you. It was clear that this woman had found hope. The next woman was the smallest woman of the group. She was very diminutive. She was very meek. She got up with a very quiet voice. I had to lean over to hear her. She said, "I was born poor. I was told I'll always be poor. And I'll never amount to anything. I was married. I had a very happy time in my life. I had three children. And then disaster struck. My husband left me. I was reduced to begging on the street to try to feed my children." And she, almost in tears, she pointed to a friend and said, "Maria invited me to join the trust bank." And I did. And I started a little enterprise. And I was able to succeed. And then you could see this lady almost get taller as she spoke, and her voice got louder, and she said, "Now, when my children are sick, I can reach into my profits and buy medicine." And then she thrust her hand out to me and said, "Now, I don't have to hold my hand out to anyone." That woman, more succinctly than anyone else I'd ever seen, explained the difference to me between relief and development. And she galvanized that calling that I felt in my heart to be a champion of the world's poor. And I'm sorry, but I lose it every time I tell that story. I'm getting better. I almost got all the way through it. I lost it, so forgive me. But that has been a real motivator for me to see how some of the world's poorest can be transformed, and more importantly, their families transformed through this process. I think also a significant thing that this woman did was lead me to the next phase of my learning, which is understanding some of the key principles of how microenterprise works. And as I said before, microenterprise success doesn't lie in the loans that it gives. Its success lies in the principles that it teaches, in the opportunities it provides, and the dignity that it gives to its clients. You know, how many people here have heard it said, "If only I had a little more money, I could be successful"? Anybody heard that? Just two? Only two heard that. Okay. They're falling asleep on us. You know, the problem with that is just a little more is never just enough. And until there's a transformation of the person's character, they'll never succeed. Because they really need two things. They need to have an honorable and reliable means to earn an income, and they have to know how to keep it. And that learning how to keep it part, which even us in the developed world are pretty poor at, is all about making a change to your character. And in order to make that character change, I think there are three characteristics that have to be present. I call them the three M's: mentality, morality, and motivation. They have to have the mentality to understand the key principles that will make them successful. I'm going to talk about those key principles in a little bit. Morality is all about an internal character trait that says, "I want to succeed in a win-win situation, a win-win relationship with others." Keep in mind, you're making less than a dollar a day. You're barely surviving. You might see a meal today. You have the opportunity to earn a penny. If I cheat the guy, I might earn three. What are you going to do? In desperation, you're going to earn three pennies. We teach our clients that if you really want to succeed, it's not about win-lose. It's about how can you develop relationships that are win-win so that that person wants to come back to you again and buy from you again. And it's really a characteristic that I think reflects the character of our Creator. And one of the key things that I think can sum all that up is learning how to make and keep a promise. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more also. The last part is the motivation. This is something that can't be taught. This is caught. This is caught by that woman who thrust her hand out to me, shaking it. She had caught the fact that she can succeed. She had moved from hopeless to hopeful. That's the motivation that allows these people to succeed. And this is Drew's corollary to that. I believe that microenterprise is successful because it taps into what I believe to be the strongest human force on earth. Anyone want to take a guess at what Drew thinks the strongest human force on earth is? Give me a wild guess, anybody. Somebody had it. What?
Love.
Love? What? You love a piece of it. It is the love a mother has for her children. She wants to see her children safe, secure, and successful. And if you give a mother earning less than a dollar a day a glimpse of an opportunity to do that for her children, you better get out of her way. And Julie can relate to it. You see the experiences time and time and time again in the developing world of mothers who have gone from begging on the streets to a successful enterprise, feeding her children, employing five other people, sending her children to college. I met a woman, and I've got to divert for 1 second. I met a woman in Guatemala who had a little business. She had a big aluminum pot and a wooden spoon, and she made tapioca and other snacks that she sold to street vendors. And I was really curious how many people she supported. And I asked her, how many people are in your enterprise? She said, oh, me, my sister, her family, my brother and his family, and five street vendors and their families. 50 people we added up. 8 out of that aluminum pot. And that was just the start. Then I said, tell me about your children. She said, oh, well, I have a daughter who's a doctor. I have a son who's an accountant. I have another one who's an engineer. And I have a daughter who's going to become a nurse. All out of that aluminum pot. But that wasn't even the end of the story. I said, well, how much education have you had? She said, 1 year. This process can truly transform the lives of the world's poor. And I'll make the case that the greatest injustice done to the people on this earth is denying them access to the opportunity to earn a living for their family. And the greatest justice performed are by those organizations. You see that those people get that opportunity. Let me go to the next slide. And let me talk about, a few other just quick comments. I love this one. Quitting is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. I got somebody to laugh. And this is a great quote by this young woman who lived in the ghetto. My dream is not to die in poverty, but to see poverty die in me. Isn't that a great thought? Let me talk about what I consider the five principles of success. And I'm going to whisper to you a little secret. This isn't just about microenterprise. This is about life. This is whether you are earning $1 a day and just entering a microenterprise program, or you're the president of General Motors, or a housewife, or a pastor. These principles apply in your life. Number one, learn how to make and keep a promise. Is that a big deal? You betcha it is. Think about it. Every relationship you're involved in, if that person can't make and keep a promise, you can't do business with them. Whether it's a storekeeper, an employee, your wife or husband, your church, unless you can learn how to make and keep a promise, you can't have a sustainable relationship. The entire premise of micro lending is all about me saying to you, you make a dollar a day, I'm going to loan you what is probably the equivalent of a month's income. I'm going to ask something out of you in the way of collateral. It's your promise. That's, you know, when the poor first hear that, it's like, whoa, wait, what did you just say? I'm going to ask for collateral, which is your promise. And when they succeed, and 98% of them do, they realize that, wow, my word has real value. And then they realize, wow, I have real value. The next item is provide value and service to others. You've all heard about the value equation. Again, this is true not only in business, but in life. Successful enterprise revolves around creating customers for life. Now, let's take it out of the business context. Success in life revolves around creating relationships for life. Same thing. Customers flock to businesses that provide real value. We flock to individuals where we can have a real relationship. And biblically, in the Old Testament, you hear God talking to his people saying, I want you to be fair to your clients. In fact, I want you to give them full measure, then I want you to pack it down, then I want you to spill it over. The principle he's trying to tell us is value and service. You go to your favorite market because you like the value and service you receive. You go to your church because you feel valued. If you don't, you got to find another church. Every relationship in life is about that equation. It's also about making a profit. But it's not a profit at the expense of someone else. It's a profit with the help of others. It's about relationships that create an interdependence, not a dependence. All things and people have value. This is another basic premise of microenterprise. When I give something of value to you, but you don't give me something of value in return, I'm really taking something from you. Anybody know what it is? And the answer's on the board. What am I taking from him if he doesn't give me something in return? If you're earning less than a dollar a day, about all you have left is your self-respect. So if I give him something rather than empowering him to do for himself, I'm stealing his self-respect. And he's going to begin to think that, gee, if I ever want anything, somebody else is going to have to give it to me, as opposed to I can do it for myself. This is a great one, and this is one I failed at for a lot of years until my wife educated me. Learn to love people and use things. How many people do you know get that backwards? They use people and love things. And finally, any effective development process is about a hand up, not a hand out. You've heard the expression, give a man a fish, help me out. Teach him how to fish, feed him for a lifetime. One more, but you haven't heard this one. Teach him to teach others to fish, feed a nation. That's what microenterprise is all about. We have two currencies of exchange, money and time. Our life is limited by one of those. You figure it out. Next. Seek to serve God by serving others. When you are helped, it's your turn to help someone else. In the case of a microenterprise client, guess what? When they become successful, they become the center point of their communities. They're the ones that found the churches, get the water systems in place, fix the trash pickup. They realize that they can do, and they use that in other parts of their life. Now, let me shift back to my original question. How many here are trying to figure out what to do with the rest of their lives? Let me give you a suggestion. Three things to think about. When you try to figure out what you're doing with your life, focus on things that Jesus cares about, whether it's business, family, church, whatever. What does Jesus care about? That's what I want to be involved in. Two, do I really feel a calling for this? All of us in this room are in the top 1% of the world. We've been blessed with the best educations, the best families, the best opportunities. Don't squander that on anything that's less than a calling for you. And here's a hint. Would you do it even if you weren't paid? If you would, it's probably a calling for you. And then, you know, we all hit bumps in the road, or ruts in our life. When you hit those, stop and ask these same questions. Because maybe one of these things aren't true anymore. If not, change it. Lost my place, but I'm there. Don't fall into the devil's trap of feeling like all of your accomplishments are because of you. Guess what? All of your accomplishments are because of the gifts God has given you. And God is asking of you, hey, I gave you all that. What are you going to do with it? Jesus is saying, are you going to bury this talent or are you going to multiply it tenfold? Life is unfair. That's a little secret. In case anybody didn't know that. Life is unfair. But God is sovereign. And as you look to address the challenges that you're going to face in life that may become your calling or mission, realize that the fundamental problem that you're addressing is probably spiritual. I may be poor because it's conditional. My country's government's corrupt. My economic system doesn't work. Or maybe it's because I'm dysfunctional. I can't get out of bed in the morning. I'm lazy or I'm addicted to something. All of those are spiritual problems. When you're attacking one of those, think about what's the underlying spiritual issue and go after that. And remember that those in the world who say, God, how can you let all these people in the world suffer? Or probably the same people are going to get to heaven and God's going to say, look at all the resources I gave you, the education I gave you, the money I gave you, the relationships, the influence. What did you do to stop the suffering of my children? Keep in mind that we live in the most developed worlds, countries in the world. We think $18,000 a year is poverty line when two-thirds of the world lives on less than $2 a day. God has given us most of the resources in this world, and He's asking of us, what are you going to do with it? Thank you.
What a challenge, Drew. And part of that empowerment that we need for the poor women, let's thank you. Part of the empowerment that we need for our clients, and particularly for the poor women of the world, is to give them a voice at the table and a voice in their community. And I love these words from Proverbs, that one of our challenges is to speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly. And I think of that primarily with the women. Women do most of the hard manual labor in the world. They often earn less than their male counterparts. In many societies, they do not have the ability to own land. So that's why microfinance targets this group. When we listen to our clients, Drew was great with giving some of the quotes. This is one of my quotes from a woman before we've given loans. I couldn't feed my family, couldn't see my future, couldn't get out of the home. That's the despair that we see. But then opportunity brings life by trusting in their words, by giving them credit when they don't feel worthy and in fact are not accepted to walk through a door of a bank. That's the whole goal of microcredit, is that we're reaching people that don't have the right to walk through the door of a bank. And we help them to feed their families by starting these small businesses. But the self-worth, the trust in self, is probably more important. We are helping them to actualize the gifts that God has given them. So empowerment, and particularly in the context of poor women, is about change. Yes, I can change my situation, my economic situation, my life situation. The options, it's the choices I have to make, and it's the choices that I can make for my children, that my children can then have. And it's about power. Activities that promote empowerment. Drew spoke a lot about the trainings. We actually have transformation modules that are given by the loan officers to the women in their weekly trust meeting. These can cover these can be Bible studies. These can be topics like conflict resolution. How do I work out conflicts with my husband? How do I discipline my children in a good manner? It can be skills that are learned. Their own literacy can be addressed in these trust bank meetings. So that's one of the ways we can. And this is in a trusted context where you can deal with issues that are difficult. It's also good for a sounding board for all of your marketing decisions, for your business decisions. What am I going to do next? And we're often in areas where, like when we were working in Guatemala, we were bringing together groups of women who couldn't get together before because the government prohibited it. So it was a supportive group for these women. And the last point, participation in governance. These women take on positions of president, secretary, treasurer. Maybe the first time in their life that they've been given these types of responsibilities. And that develops leadership. And that leadership then spreads over into their communities. It also has a generational effect because there's modeling behavior. They see the self-esteem in their mother or grandmother. They see the successfulness. They see the respect in the eyes of the community to that woman as she does her business. And that has far-reaching implications. So we see self-worth. This is a quote from a client in Ghana. They didn't count me worthy to be called when there was a problem or decision making, but now through her trust bank, I am numbered among human beings. This is a person that didn't feel she was treated as a human being before. but through the value she found, through us trusting in her and giving that loan, she did. And certainly, one of the things that we see is that women then have more decision-making because of controlling the surplus, and that there are benefits to the family. So those include nutrition, health, education, and well-being. Next slide. One of the things that I particularly found interesting, and this is a study that was done by the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health with Wisdom, which is a World Vision partner in Ethiopia. And they actually, through their research, found, and this was during 2002-2003, which is a time of drought when there was food insecurity, that children of women clients were found to have less malnutrition compared to community children. And in fact, better nutrition than community children or children of male clients. And they didn't get to the core of that. But again, we see that women use their profits primarily for input back into the family. And we actually have found in some of our cases that men clients will go to other culturally defined causes, like in the Philippines, it would be cockfighting, but some of the profits go to that. In Russia, it could be alcohol. There can be some disparities. Education. Our cross-sectional studies, not longitudinal, so we can't assume that there's any causation, but at least our first research, which is cross-sectional, tells us that the longer you're in trust banks, the more of the children go to school, both male and female children go to school. There's impact on contributions to the church. Tatiana was one of the first clients that I met when I was in Russia and was actually the person that convinced me God was at work and opportunity. Her business was re-inking typewriter cartridges. And yes, this was a successful business. And it was so successful that she was able to give over 50% of her profits back to the church. So the blessing, having enough money to give away, is a really wonderful feeling when you've been destitute. And then to have the freedom to give that money to the church is a sign of transformation. Transformation in the community. One of my favorite illustrations of affecting the environment is in the Tondo in the Philippines. Who knows what the Tondo is in the Philippines? Well, it's like a smoky mountain. It's a garbage dump where a lot of people have built their homes, literally on the garbage dump itself. These women, again, we were listening to our clients because they're the ones who have wisdom. They knew that diarrheal diseases were taking the lives of their children. So what do you need? You need purified water. There was purified water for sale through reverse osmosis technology, which is a poor process. Nikki, probably many of you know about this, but it was a bit expensive. They told us the need. We connected them with UV technology from California, two-step process. Halved the price of the water. So purified water was now accessible to many, many more in the time. And it was this group of women that combined their loans to start a water purification. Usually we don't bring in technologies, but because of that need, we did help them with identifying the technology that they could bring in. Some of the other things that we have done in redeeming communities is one area in Barranquilla, Colombia. The women identified that it was a poor lighting led to the violence in the area. They were able to go before the government and bring in electricity to their barrio, and the robbery rates. Some of our women in Peru are joining with a government program to running soup kitchens. The government is supplying the money, but they are actually donating their time outside of their business running time in running the soup kitchens. We learned in some communities, once you advance from the trust bank model, you need a bit bigger loan. So part of the senior trust bank was to meet in, this was also in Peru, only twice a month, but they added a community development project, and often this was planting trees. That may seem small, but if you think of these houses that are built literally on waste dirt that has been piled up and is subject to erosion and mudslides, planting trees and securing that earth is a huge improvement. It's transforming, it's improving their quality of life. Next one. Also systems. One of the banks that I visited this summer in one of our European countries that we serve in had combated unethical practices that was part of the culture, and they treated rich clients and poor clients equally. They treated them fairly, and there were no under-the-table deals, and so all of a sudden, they started getting all the clients. And the other banks were going, what's going on here? You know, they must have a customer service secret. And then they found out it was the ethical business practice. And so, you know, success brings copying. And other banks started copying those ethical business practices. So there is also the opportunity to impact system change in this way. And then the micro insurance is something that we have started. And I think I'll address that a little bit later. This is Zambia's Nutella program. And Nutula, sorry, means to share one's burden or to lighten someone's load. And you can see the specifics on this. What is significant is it's the first time that we've been able to join with a large insurance company. We serve only as the broker, but it's the first time families in Africa that have seropositive family members can buy insurance, and it covers the death benefit. And again, securing it. We see from the medical viewpoint that in dealing with AIDS, you have a continuum of prevention, treatment, providing antiretrovirals, and support of the family. So, and microfinance traditionally is really good on the prevention that we teach in the trusted medium, and now it's also good at the support of the family through things like this insurance program. Our core values, I just wanted to touch on as another thing to remind you that it would be good to look at in organizations. What are their core values? Ours are respect, commitment to the poor, integrity, and stewardship. And let me give you a couple examples, but there is a film on one that I would like to show you to end our time. Respect, I just did an accreditation in Peru. We do accreditations that are two-tiered. We have bankers come in, a team of English bankers that do the financial side, and then we often have board members that come in and do the mission accreditation. What that means is we look at our core values, integrity, respect, commitment to the poor, and stewardship, and we interview everyone from the chair of the board to the CEO to the loan officers to the clients in the field to see if we are adhering to our own standards. And what I found on one accreditation in Peru was they were exhibiting respect to their staff and their clients, but they didn't expect that we as the donor community would respect them enough to listen to their ideas. And they reached a bit of a dilemma in that the trust bank model was not giving big enough loans and they needed to expand it, but they thought that we wouldn't listen to their ideas. And so we had to grow in the idea that we needed to work with them to help them understand that we would respect their wishes and would then help them change their business ideas. Next. Commitment to the poor. Again, the client products. We've talked about these, but let me just mention these two. Besides the death benefit insurance, we are now starting, and this is just in the pilot phase, scratch vouchers for malarial treatment. This is a treatment card that you person buys and then anybody in their family could use it when they needed it. But not just the treatment. We have a second card that is a lower price and it comes with a mosquito net that has pesticide permeated. So it's a lower price for them to do the prevention to keep family members from getting it in the first place, which to me is just brilliant. And what an innovation. And we'll be doing some research to see, you know, if people will buy and use the net and how this usage comes in. But it's another way that business, through insurance, can make an impact on one of the malaria, which is one of the biggest issues that we face in parts of Africa. And then the apprentice program. These ladies are AIDS orphans. These ladies have no parents. These ladies may have been forced into trafficking to earn a living. But instead, our microfinance enterprise has created apprenticeship programs where they can learn viable skills. And in this situation, they were learning tailoring. And the woman in the big hat is their instructor. And not only were they learning tailoring, they were learning marketing and customer satisfaction. And they were increasing in the role of self-esteem. And they did a good job because I got one of them dressing up. So that is one of our wonderful parts of our program. Integrity, one more down. Listening to clients, and this is one of our clients who has benefited from our insurance program and in helping to put her daughter through college where she's becoming a law student in Uganda. And then stewardship. Being responsible for donor money also means that we need to be transparent. And let me just tell you one of our horror stories. We found that one of our Latin American partners had put the grant funds that we had given them to give out in loans into Emerald. And the reason they had done this was, at least the reason they told us they'd done this, was that they would make a big profit when they sold them, and then they'd have more money to give out as loans. Well, the Emerald market tanked. They lost all the money. We had to go back to the donor. So, you know, what spin did we give on that? We decided both to have integrity and the stewards, we needed to be transparent. And we told them exactly what had happened. And actually, this organization, we had to start up all over again because the board and the CEO were both involved in this operation. But because we were transparent and had that integrity to the donor, they understood the situation and are still a good donor to us today. So I think that says a lot about an organization if you can learn from your mistakes and be transparent both up and down the case. Okay. And the partnerships, but really we're looking for is the future generation, is what microfinance is for. I would like to show you this film. Are you going to start that, or is it Joe? And it tells the story of one of the women that we have served, and I think tangibly captures the transformation that we strive for in many, many different respects. And then we'll have a brief time for questions here.